Good evening, my respected friends. The Christadelphians of this area give to you a very warm welcome to hear this Bible-based lecture concerning what will Russia do next? The Bible answer. Our lecturing brother, Mr. Dan Jolly, has asked that by way of introduction to his comments this evening, that we read from Ezekiel chapter 38, verses 1 to verse 15. What will Russia do next? The Bible answer. So we call upon Mr. Dan Jolly to address us to that title.
Good evening, everybody. And thank you, Brother Chairman, for that introduction. What I want to look at this evening, our title, What Will Russia Do Next? The Bible's Answer. It's one of those subjects where we've believed Bible truths for over 100 years in this community. 1848, Elpis Israel, the truths that Brother Thomas took from the Bible and interpreted. We believe very much the same thing today. And about 2 years ago, Russia began its invasion of Ukraine. And as we watched those events, those who had been in the truth for a little bit longer, were a little bit older, expected that Russia would romp across Ukraine like a ravaging bear, finish the job in weeks, at the most months, and be on the borders of Europe proper. And that's not what we saw, was it? We didn't see this demonstration of the military prowess of Russia that we expected. We saw something quite different. We saw, well, it felt like we saw a Russia that was stopped in its tracks and then pushed back, slowed down, at least for a while. And yes, there's talk about them progressing again, but it's slowly, it's painful. And that's been a real surprise. What looks like, on the surface of things, a vastly inferior army in Ukraine and certainly a much less well-prepared defender has managed to slow down and stop the might of the Russian military. The war rumbles on. continuing to be more or less front page news, depending on how much space is left after outrage over the latest attack in Gaza. There might be a few columns still left for a discussion very briefly of what's happening in Russia. And that war continues to progress. And between the war in Gaza, the war in Ukraine, global warming, growing global unease, you may have said to yourself, well, where's the world headed? What's going to happen next? What's going on? And as people who have believed in the Bible all of our lives, it's possible for us to look at the events we've seen in the last few months, years in Ukraine and go, it kind of doesn't fit. It doesn't feel right. Did we get everything wrong? And to worry that maybe we didn't quite understand things right. And what we want to do this evening is we want to take a little bit of a deep dive. We want to reconvince ourselves of exactly the interpretation of Ezekiel 38. We want to kind of go down the rabbit hole and make sure that we know why we believe what we believe. And for those of you perhaps watching on Zoom or watching on YouTube at a later point in time, we want to spend some time making sure that we understand who Ezekiel was talking about and what is the future for Russia as described in the Bible. What will Russia do next? And by the way, the events that follow, what Russia will do next, is very much intertwined with those events in Israel and Gaza. In fact, the end of our story is, isn't it, a solution to the intractable Middle East problem. And indeed, all the other problems that our world faces, the problem of global warming, the problem of global instability, the problem of migration crisis and economic migrants, all of those problems will be resolved by the events that follow after what Russia does next. And so it's a very exciting time for us to consider and to discuss and look at. And we want to hopefully by the end of tonight get to our positive conclusion of all these problems for the whole world. So let's get started. Well, the obvious question, and I'm just going to try and put this up here without making too much noise. Where is Russia mentioned in the Bible? And oops, we'll fix that in just a sec. Give me a tick. Where is Russia mentioned in the Bible? Well, the obvious answer is it's mentioned in Ezekiel 38. We wouldn't have read Ezekiel 38 if that wasn't where it was mentioned. And for those of us looking down at our Bibles, verse 2, there it is, in verse 2, there's Russia. Son of man, set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. And some of you will be looking at your laps. Hopefully all the young people are looking at their laps and saying, hold it just a minute, it's not there. Most Bibles that we would have in this room, King James Version fans as we are, don't have the word Rosh in verse 2. Where it says there, son of man, set your face against Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal. That word chief is in the Hebrew the word Rosh. And so some Bibles translate that word Rosh as chief. That's what the King James Bible does. And other Bibles, of course, don't do that. They translate it, transliterate it as a proper noun. So there's two different paths that are taken by different Bible translators. The King James translators chose to translate the word Rosh there. And other translators chose to transliterate the word, write or print a letter for letter copy of the closest corresponding letters into a different script. So some of you should be saying to yourselves, well, given that the word Rosh doesn't even appear in the Bible on my lap, where do we get the idea that Rosh should be in my Bible? And far less, how do we know that Rosh has anything to do with Russia? Well, I want to show you that tonight. So what we're looking at here, it's a shot of the most ancient copies of Ezekiel 38 in existence that we've found. Actually, the bits I'm talking about are the circled ones. So what this is these are not the Dead Sea Scrolls, in fact. Ezekiel, parts of Ezekiel was found amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, but none of Ezekiel 37 or 38 was found in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In fact, Yigal Yadin, the gentleman responsible for excavating many of the Dead Sea Scrolls, also had another dig site about the same time, between about 63 and 65, Masada. And in the floor of a synagogue at Masada, they found two key documents, part of Deuteronomy and part of Ezekiel. And that's what you can see on the screen. And unfortunately, as far as I can tell, there is only one place in the world at the moment where you can get a look at the Ezekiel scrolls that were found at Masada. And it just happens to be in this book here, Masada version 5, version 6, the Yigal Yadin excavations. And for some reason, I haven't yet purchased myself a copy of that particular book. I've left that one maybe for a generous benefactor to help me out with. So the only photographs of Ezekiel as found at Masada, which is the only ancient Hebrew copy that includes Ezekiel 37 and 38, there are no others, is in this book, and it's never been released for photograph anywhere else, as far as I can tell. So the circled bits, which are identified as blank pieces of parchment, are the only pieces of parchment that I can find that actually come from the Ezekiel scroll as found at Masada. So it's not very helpful. But what I can reassure you is that Ezekiel 37, most of it, and Ezekiel 38, at least the first 8 or 9 verses, were all found intact at Masada. And just haven't been released for us to see. The point of that being that, well, Ezekiel 38 isn't a made-up volume. It wasn't invented at some point along the line. It is an ancient document with real provenance. We can prove it's been around for a long, long time, and we know that it has real historical validity. So, the oldest translations, as opposed to the oldest Hebrew copies of Ezekiel 38, treated this word rosh as a proper noun. So the word rosh is the one we're talking about. It's the word chief in verse 2, translated as chief in your Bible. Well, the oldest translations into Greek, Koine Greek was the first language into which the Bible was translated as far as we know, all, without exception, transliterated the word rosh as a proper noun. Now, I'm going to explain why this is important, because you might look at that and go, well, so what? So here we've got the Septuagint, probably the oldest translation from Aramaic and Hebrew into Greek, doubtless older than 100 BC, and therefore, by the way, older than about 90% of the Dead Sea Scrolls. Theodotion in 150, Symmachus in 190, and the Codex Vaticanus, all of them treat this word rosh as a proper noun. And the reason I've excluded Codex Sinaiticus from this list is because Codex Sinaiticus, for those of you who have a copy of this at home, misses Ezekiel. So let me show you what we're talking about, and I hope all of you are going to see why this is important. So here on your screen is a page from Codex Vaticanus. This is a Koine Greek copy of a translation of the Bible, and as you can see, beautifully handwritten and found amongst the Vatican archives, and now one of the oldest, virtually complete manuscripts of the Old Testament in Greek. And what we've got on the screen here just happens, by coincidence, to be chapter 38 of Ezekiel. Go figure. There you are, chapter 38 of Ezekiel. Hopefully you can see that. On the far side, it says cap XXXVIII. For those of you who are excellent at your Roman numerals, that is not, that's chapter 38. And Ezekias, they spelled Ezekiel wrong back then. We don't know quite why, but they did. All right, so this is Ezekiel 38. And The chapter begins about here. There's a chapter break marking, and I'm going to show you the bit we're really interested in. So here it is. Rosh, Meshech, Chi, and Tobel. Chi being and. So it says Archon, which is the word for prince, of Rosh in green, Meshech in blue, Tobel in red. Why is that significant? Well, here's why. The Septuagint translation was done, we believe, probably even further back than 100 BC. It may have been done as early as the late 3rd century BC, and it's a translation from Hebrew into Greek. And rather than using the word in Greek that corresponded to chief, they transliterated the word here as Rosh. So they haven't translated, they've transliterated. They've taken the same sounds and got the same sounds into their Greek Bible, and it's a name, Rosh. Now, that's really important because it tells us that back at 300 BC, just 200 or 300 years after Ezekiel, these scholars believed that this was a name, a recognizable name. Now, here's why this is really, really interesting. Just two chapters later, in Ezekiel chapter 40, exactly the same word shows up again in the Septuagint, except this time they didn't translate it. Sorry, they didn't transliterate it, they translated it. And in Ezekiel chapter 40, it talks about the beginning or the first. And in that passage, it's translated using the Greek word protos. But here, they've transliterated. The same word in the Hebrew, but very different treatments between two different chapters, showing us that the translators, when they came across this word, made a conscious decision and said, this is a name. It's a name of a place. We know that to be true. That's really important. In fact, nobody assumed that this word Rosh here should be translated chief or anything else until the Catholic scholar and all-round scoundrel Jerome wrote his Vulgate Bible. And because the Bible atlas he happened to have on his desk at that time didn't show Rosh on it, he said, well, that's nonsense, and decided to do away with the proper noun and translate it as chief. The Greeks in the 3rd century BC understood that Rosh referred to a nation, most likely because Rosh was a nation that they had heard of. But by the time of Jerome, almost 6 centuries later on, Jerome couldn't find Rosh, and so translated rather than transliterating the word. So that's pretty important. So Septuagint, Theodotion, Symmachus, Codex Vaticanus all thought it was a name of a place, and I add, same with the Quran. And you might think, well, so what? The Quran. Well, look, the Quran is a book that clearly has sections that take its lead, a derivative of the Bible. And it has numerous source pieces that come straight from the Old Testament. And it too mentions Rosh as a proper noun. And just in case we're thinking, well, that's just an accidental phenome that just happens to sound similar. No, the books of the Quran refer to lots of similar names to the Bible, like Gog and Magog, because it's drawing from the same source material. Muhammad got his information from a similar place in that he was copying material out of the Bible to use as a foundation for parts of the Quran. Well, Ezekiel mentions Magog in the same breath as Rosh and Meshech and Tubal, and you can see here that when Muhammad penned his text, he clearly felt convinced that this name Rosh referred to a people and a place, and he uses names like Magog and Gog as well. And so Bible scholar after Bible scholar comes to the conclusion that this phrase here should be translated not Gog, the land of Magog, the chief prince, but no, instead Gog, the land of Magog, prince of Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And so if your Bible says chief, cross it out and write Rosh above it. That is the right way to interpret this. Now, If any of you have done any research on this subject and really gone down the rabbit hole on this, you may well have come across the argument that using a proper noun for that place where it says chief is actually grammatically incorrect. And that's true. It is. It's grammatically incorrect in the Hebrew to have that word as rosh. However, here's the problem for people who use that argument to say that rosh shouldn't be there. It should be chief. It is more grammatically incorrect to have the word chief there. And in fact, the grammatically incorrect rosh or proper noun in that space in a sentence is used numerous times by Ezekiel. But to put the word chief there instead or a similar word in that grammatical structure is never ever used by Ezekiel. And so, yes, it's grammatically incorrect. It just happens that that was a grammatical incorrectness that Ezekiel quite liked and he used it quite often. And so scholars like Smith concluded that rosh should be read as a proper noun in this context. Now, I know that's a really deep dive, but it is important because you are going to come across people who say, no, not true. You don't need to worry about that. Rosh has nothing to do with Russia. Some of you may have heard of Jesenius, Wilhelm Jesenius. He was perhaps the greatest Hebraist ever to study the Bible. He was a German lexicographer. Perhaps some of you have got the English translation of his lexicon at home. For those of you who have, it's a real page turner, so it's probably on your reading desk right now. One volume, 900 pages of definitions of every Hebrew word in the Bible. What most people don't know about Jesenius is this, that the one we've got is a massively abridged edition. The original, written in Latin, spanned five volumes, and in the three volumes that I've been able to get access to, there are over 3,300 pages just in those three volumes. There's two more I haven't been able to find access for yet. And while the little version that we have on our shelves in English makes it clear that Jesenius was in no doubt what Rosh referred to, he thought it was undoubtedly the Russians, it's still a very abridged definition. Here's what he says in his non-abridged definition. Actually, just so you know, here's what he says in his non-abridged definition. The bit I had on the screen a second ago is just the red bits. He says a lot on Rosh in his non-abridged edition. Unfortunately, for those who've got really good eyesight, you will realize that that is Latin. And it's never been translated into any other language other than Latin. And so it's pretty hard to work with. But nonetheless, here's what he says in his Latin edition. Some excerpts. Rosh is a proper noun. It's a northern Scythian race, which Ezekiel 38 and 39 linked with the Tiberini, Tubal, and Moshki, the Meshech, as dwelling near the Black Sea. He goes on to say the people called the Ros in Greek, the Rus in Arabic, or the Rus in Latin are frequently mentioned by Byzantine and Oriental writers as inhabiting the area of the Crimea. Georgius Monachus, a 10th century AD writer, describes the Ros as a wild, rustic Scythian people. The name of the Roxolani is the union of the name of Ros or Rox with the name of the Alani people, thus indicating either a merger of these two people or that the Alans were from the territory of the Ros. Now, the Roxolani lived between the Tauros and the Alans, but around Lake Moesius, in other words, the Sea of Azov, which is at the top of the Black Sea. So what he's saying is this. He's saying Rosh is a name. It is almost always connected with Meshech and Tubal. It refers to a Scythian nation who in Byzantine times lived near the Black Sea and the Crimea. And while it's called Rosh in Ezekiel, they became known as the Roxolani when they merged with another tribe later on. That's really interesting. Another writer, a little bit earlier, Georgius Hornius, an unfortunate name, he said almost exactly the same thing. The Rossi occupied the Taurica among the people of the Scythians, and Ezekiel Ross is mentioned as correctly by the following authors. The Ross were the Roxolani. So what we want to do now is kind of trace these people. Work out how these men got this information and why they thought that. So here we go. Firstly, sometimes people say, well, just because something sounds like something else doesn't mean it's the same thing. It's true, but it is a very, very good way of tracing things. And in fact, it is a way that is used by people who study nations and tribes. The fact that people use a similar sound, a similar name, means that most likely they have some similarities, may even be the same people. And furthermore, because of differences in inflection and accent between different nations, when you read about the Rus or the Ras or the Resh, they're probably all the same people. So that's just a point in passing, and it's important to note. And one other thing, sometimes we get worried because we pick up our Bible and at the back of our Bible there's a map, and that map says Magog, and it puts Magog bang in the middle of Turkey. You think, well, what do we do with that? Well, it just so happens that there's been a lot of movement over the years. And the people of Magog most likely were in Turkey at some point in their history. In fact, there was a period, an era of history described as the migration era, in which people were moving every which way and very, very fast. There's been a lot of movement over the years. And the people we're talking about, Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, were at least at times nomadic, and we should expect them to move. Okay, let's try and do this quickly because it'll get really boring if I do it slowly. I'm going to show you a bit of a timeline of where Rosh shows up in the historical record. So, first one I could find, perhaps, Hatshepsut. It's not a name I'd want to say in a hurry. She recorded one of her victories and she talked about invading successfully the land of the Reshu and that they could not hide from her majesty. And if you look at it, you can understand why no one could hide from that majesty. Perhaps that is the first mention of Rosh, we don't know. But the second is Ezekiel. Now, you might want to turn this one up because some of you will be thinking, I've looked at this passage before and there's no Rosh in this passage. So let's go there, Ezekiel 66. Verse 19. Sorry, Isaiah 66, verse 19. Simeon there whispering to me, you've got it wrong again. Always, Daniel, you've got it wrong. Okay, Isaiah 66, verse 19. Where Isaiah says, and I will set a sign among them, and I will send those that escape of them unto the nations, to Tarshish, Pul, and Lud, that draw the bow, to Tubal, to Javan, to the isles far off that not have not heard my name. And on the surface of it, it looks like a list of nations, except for the fact that in the middle of it, there's this strange phrase, to those that draw the bow. Now, the earliest clear mention that I have been able to find of Rosh, I believe, in the Bible is in that passage. And if you're wondering, well, where is it? It is that phrase, to those that draw the bow. It's mentioned there between Lud and Tubal. And the Septuagint translators, again, helped us out because they interpreted that phrase, that draw, in the King James, with the Hebrew word mashak, that's what it is in Hebrew, as meshek. He said it should be meshek, a proper noun, which leaves us with the bit, the bow. What do we do with the bow? Well, just so happens that just a few years after Isaiah's work was released and came into common circulation, that the people went into captivity. And while they were in Babylon, the Jewish script changed. Isaiah would have been written in Phoenician script, Proto-Hebrew script, which was very different to what they came back from Babylon with, which is the Hebrew square script. And a number of observers have noted that you would only have to make one little mistake, actually two little mistakes, in knowing how to convert between the old script and the new script to go all of the way from a sentence or a word that can be translated as the bow through to a name that can be translated as Rosh. And so most likely because, well, Meshach is always with Rosh, is always with Tubal in the Bible. This would be the one example, I think, where it isn't. Meshach should be here, and in all probability, this should also include Rosh. This should have Meshach, Rosh, and Tubal together as a list of nations that in the age to come will hear the glory of God. So that's 720 BC, give or take. Isaiah talks most probably about Rosh and Meshach and Tubal. Sargon, the great Assyrian king, talked about how he managed to cut down his foes all over the place, including the Mushki, in other words, Meshach, and as well the people of the Rashi, Rosh. Another empire that was almost as large and at times larger than the Assyrian Empire, even though we hear nothing about them in the Bible, was the Urartu Kingdom. It was just north of the Assyrian Kingdom and at times was dominant. And the Urartu King Rusa, nothing to do with Russia in this case, mentions how he invaded the land of Ruhisha. And scholars believe that this may be the same group of people, the people of the Rash or the Rosh. A few years later, Ashurbanipal, same thing. He invaded the land of the Rashi. And then along comes Ezekiel, and he talks about Rosh. And you can understand, therefore, that when Ezekiel spoke about Rosh, sitting as he was in a vast cosmopolitan empire, the Babylonian kingdom, which would have had ambassadors here, there, and everywhere, they would have known where Rosh and Meshach and Tubal were. They wouldn't have been unknown places to the people of Babylon. They were on the borders of their empire. And they would have known exactly who they were and potentially what they traded in. A few years later on, Herodotus doesn't speak of Rosh, but he speaks of the Meshach people, the Moshki and the Tibrani, the people of Tubal. A few years later on, Strabo, the historian, talks about the Roxolanes living in the area between the Caspian and the Black Sea. And Pliny, the elder in 79 AD, talks about the same group of people. A few years later on, Cornelius Tacitus mentions the Roxolani and tells me there was some Martian tribe. Now, that was another part of the Scythian group of barbarian nations who in the end occupied all the way from far northern Turkey through to the Arctic Circle. Ptolemy, the great map maker, also mentions the people of the Roxolani and tells us that they were inland on the coast of the Black Sea. The Arabic scholars are particularly helpful because they were traveling from the south and they were trading all around the world in the 800s and 900s AD. And they mention again and again throughout their books the Rus merchants that they encountered and said that they were a Slavic, in other words, a Sarmatian or Scythian people. And finally, the Primary Chronicle, which is the basis of Russian history books, talks about the Rus being, and note this, the first princes of Kiev. So what we've got here is an almost unbroken line of history, of historical records mentioning the same people. We don't always know exactly where they are from those accounts, but we know that they existed and would have been known. And we can trace their journey, if you like, from far northern Turkey, earlier than 600 BC, drifting up into the Caucasus around 100 BC, pushing over to the far side of the Black Sea by the time that the Romans were becoming dominant in this region, and then finally up into modern-day Ukraine and Belarusia. So, the big question then, where or who is Rosh today? And some of you who know me may have seen this map before. Here's where Rosh ended up. Lying neatly over the territories of modern-day Ukraine and Belarusia with Kiev as its capital. And the ancient term, the Rus or the Kievan Rus, applied to all of this territory. And so if we were forced to pick one nation rather than several that best encapsulates the territory of Rosh, it's actually not Russia at all. It's Ukraine. Even though you can see here on this map that it does include all of the way up to Moscow and past, it includes all of Belarusia and Minsk, its capital, and it includes most of Ukraine, it was centered around Kiev and the Kingdom of Kiev. And so here we have a description for us of where to look for the Rus. Now, I just want to show you one other interesting thing about the Rus, these people, the Kievan Rus. So that's according to their histories, their first Kievan leader, Oleg of Novgorod. Let me show you the next few leaders. Here they are. Igor, Olga, Vyacheslav, Yaropolk, Vladimir, Vyacheslav, and Sivilod. Great Ukrainian names. But you'd notice what's being circled there? Every single one of them, now these are the people right at the top of that Kievan kingdom. They are the pinnacle of the regime in Kiev. And they're all called prince, every single one of them apart from a princess. Not sure how she snuck in, but she did. All prince. You might say, well, why is that significant? What's important about that? Well, let's go back to Ezekiel 38 and cast our eyes back at the text again. Because it's there. It's in the text. Ezekiel 38 and verse 2. It's quite interesting to find a kingdom in which the kings always define themselves as princes. And yet when we go to Ezekiel 38 verse 2, it says, Son of man, set your face against Gog and the land of Magog. I'm quoting from the Septuagint here. Ros, prince of Mosok, and Tobal. Prince. And the word there is not Melech for king. It's actually the word Nasi for prince. It means a ruler of various different sorts, but it is very different to the word used typically for king. And so I think that's quite significant. Ezekiel had it right. Here is a group of people who don't have kings, have princes. So, all right, enough deep dive. Let's just get through the next few nations quite quickly. Meshek, who's Meshek? Well, I've chosen to take Sir Walter Raleigh's definition tonight. The famous pirate thought that would be fun. And he says, for these Meshekika, which Ptolemy calls the Moshkai, inhabit Syracenina, can't even pronounce it, a province of Armenia, directly south from the mountains of Meshiki, and so on and so on. And he says, of this Meshek are descended also the Moscovians, thus saith Melanchthon. And it may be that in the process of time, some of them inhabited these regions also. So Sir Walter Raleigh was reasonably convinced that from these people came the Muscovites. And you might think, well, is there any support for that? Well, the territory in which Moscow is just happens to be called the Meshek area lowlands. Just happens to be. And you can see here a sort of flow of names, and that is a valid way to follow a group of people. In fact, there is a branch of study called hydrotoponymy, in which what they do in this branch of study is they just look at the names of lakes and rivers. That's all they do. Look at the names of lakes and rivers, and then they look for names and lakes of rivers that happen to be similar. Because, you know, you come across a river and, well, it looks like the last river I came to, I'll name it the same thing. You run out of names for rivers eventually, particularly if you're a nomadic people. And so what they noticed is that nomadic people very often name rivers the same thing in multiple different places. And so you end up being able to trace those people by the fact that they used similar names in all sorts of places. And so the fact that you'd have a group of people called the Meshekarians or the Moshkians way down between the Caspian and the Black Sea, and then they name their territory exactly the same thing up in the middle of Russia is no surprise. And what about Tubal? Well, Josephus tells us that Tubal gave rise to the Thobeles, who are now called the Iberes. And he places them also between the Caspian and the Black Sea. Very similar location. But here's a map of Russia. And you can see a bunch of pins on that. Now, those pins are probably too small for you to read. But starting at the bottom, those places are Tobolsky, Tobol, the River Tobol, the Rika Tobol, Tobolovo, the Tobol River, Tobolsk, Tobolsky, and Ostrovov Tobolsko. Anyone spot the similarity? It's tricky. I'll go through them again if you didn't get it the first time. Yeah? Uncle Rod needs me to go through it again, I think. No? All good. All right. So there's a real commonality there. And what it appears is that these people of Tobol, the Tbilisi of ancient times that the Assyrians spoke about, were pushed north by various different events and further north. And they ended up on the far side of this range of mountains you can see here, the Ural Mountains, on the eastern side of the Ural Mountains in a broad swath of territory. And so we could say, well, that's the territory occupied by the people of Tobol. And when we put this all together, that's what we've got. Rosh, Meshech, and Tubal. And when you think about it, that's a pretty good description of a united Russia. Particularly given that the outline was provided 2,500 years before today. It's pretty amazing when you think about it that 2,500 years ago, when the people in question lived in completely different parts of the world, that God was able to predict so precisely the layout of the world in our time and give us clues that allowed us to trace these people into the current day. So I think we can have real confidence when we read our Bibles and we read Brother Thomas and others, and they tell us that word there, Rosh, speaks of the Russians and Meshech speaks of the Moscovites and so on and so on. We can have a lot of confidence in what they said. They were basing it on scholars who had genuinely done some substantial research, and modern day research has yet to undermine their findings as much as it might want to try. So, as we wrap things up, what does Russia want? Well, Ezekiel 38 tells us, doesn't it? I will go up against the land of unwalled villages. I will fall upon the quiet people who dwell securely, all of them dwelling without walls, having neither bars nor gates. I will seize the spoil. I will carry off plunder. The Russians will turn their hand against the waste places that are now inhabited and the people who are gathered from the nations who have acquired livestock and goods who dwell at the center of the earth. That's what they want. But there's a reason they want that, isn't there? And I think this is very relevant to our time. Verse 10 tells us that it will come to pass at the same time that thou shalt, things shall come into your mind, and you, O Gog and your army, will think an evil thought. And I think we're seeing that evil thought today in the world around us, aren't we? I don't think there's anybody alive in this hall who has ever seen, unless some of you are old enough to remember the Second World War and happen to live in Germany, who has ever seen the rise of anti-Semitism like we're seeing it today. It's next level. This is really terrifying stuff. Have a look at what it says in verse 23. It says this. At the end of this whole story, God says, thus will I magnify myself and sanctify myself, and I will be known in the eyes of many nations. Now, I want you to sort of hold your hand in Ezekiel 38 and flick back 10 chapters to Ezekiel 28. Because in Ezekiel 28, Ezekiel repeats, is told to repeat similar information. He says in verse 25 this, he says, "Thus says the Lord God, when I have gathered the house of Israel from the people among whom they were scattered, and shall be sanctified in them in the sight of the heathen, the nations." This is the same language as Ezekiel 38. "Then shall they dwell in their land that I have given to my servant Jacob. And they shall dwell safely and build houses and plant vineyards. Yea, they shall dwell with confidence." When? "When I have executed judgments upon all those that despise them." That's the evil thought. God will be sanctified in the nations who despise the Jewish people. And we're seeing a global rise of anti-Semitism. It's a horrific and terrible thing that a whole planet together would choose to condemn God's people. And we know exactly where Russia is going. We're told in Ezekiel 38, "To the desolate land that is now inhabited, against the nation that is gathered back from many nations." And for those on YouTube later on who are saying, "Well, where is that land and who is this nation?" Let's just go to Ezekiel 37 to round out the picture. Ezekiel 37, the chapter before, and incidentally a chapter that flows straight into 38, which chapter 38 begins with "and." It flows on from chapter 37. Chapter 37 and verse 11 says this, "Then said he unto me, Son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say our bones are dried, our hope is lost, we are cut off from our path." So in Ezekiel chapter 37, Ezekiel was given a vision of a valley of dry bones, full of dry bones. And then he saw that valley of dry bones, which was so evocative of the events that occurred last time there was a storm of anti-Semitism like this one. And he saw that valley of dry bones come back to life. And verse 22, Ezekiel was told, "I will make these people of the valley of dry bones, I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. One king will be king to them all. They will no longer nor be two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms anymore." And so God promised that he would regather the people of Israel from wherever they were. Just as he said in verse 8 of chapter 38, where he says, "After many days in the latter years, Gog will come into the land that is brought back from the sword and that is gathered out of many people." That's the Jewish people. The Jewish people are the ones who are gathered out of many people. They are the ones who inhabit the mountains of Israel. And so when we wonder where Russia will invade, they will invade Israel because they have an evil thought of anti-Semitic hatred. Perhaps they see that they will be lauded as heroes if they can single-handedly solve the problem of Gaza. Who knows? But when they come, they won't come as peacemakers. Verse 16 of 38 tells us, "You will come up against my people Israel like a cloud covering the land. In the latter days, I will bring you against my land that the nations may know me through you, O Gog, when I vindicate my holiness before their eyes." And the army of this individual Gog, an unknown person, we do not know who Gog is yet, leading the army of Rush, Meshach and Tubal, Ukraine, Greater Russia and Siberia, will invade the Middle East, will attack the people of Israel, and seek to end the Jewish problem that the world has struggled with since the time of Jesus Christ. And how does this all end? Well, Ezekiel 38 told us how it would all end, but let's go to a different ending. Let's go to Psalm chapter 2. Let's look at the description Psalm 2 gives us of how this story ends. Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, led by this unknown individual, Gog, invades the Middle East and attacks the land of Israel, a land that God has said he loves and a people that God says he will never allow to be finished. Well, Psalm 2 talks about this period of time. Verse 1, why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together. Verse 6, yet, says God, I will indeed, and then I will have set my king upon my holy mount of Zion. I will declare the decree, says the Lord. You are my son, this day have I begotten thee. And so time is coming when the Son of God will be established as the King of Israel, the King in Zion. Verse 9, that king will break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. In the end, there will be nothing left of the Russian army that comes to invade the Middle East and prosecute its evil thought. And what happens then? Well, Psalm 72, one of the most beautiful psalms in the Bible. Psalm 72, again, an appeal to that king, the king that God establishes in Zion. Give the king your judgments, O God, your righteousness unto the king's son, because he will judge your people with righteousness, your poor with judgment. The mountains will bring peace to the people and the little hills by judgment. After the Lord Jesus Christ has finished this invasion, has defeated Gog and his armies on the mountains of Israel, he will establish peace and justice and equity. Verse 7, in his days shall righteousness flourish and the abundance of peace so long as the moon endures. How long does the moon endure for? As far as I know, it's always been there. It's been there since I was little. I imagine it'll be there when I'm old too. And so this peace will endure as long as that moon lasts. It will have dominion from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. Verse 12, he will deliver the needy when they cry, the poor also that has no helper. Verse 15, he will live and to him will be given the gold of Sheba. Prayer will be made for this king continually and daily shall this king be praised because there will be a handful of corn in the earth in the top of the mountains, even in the very tops of the mountains where these days there is no arable land. People will be able to gain food and the fruit will shake like Lebanon, like a well-forested mountain slope. And they of the city will flourish like the grass of the earth, and his name shall endure forever. Verse 8, blessed be the Lord God, and we're going to insert some words here, who protects Israel in the time of their invasion by Russia, by Rosh, Meshach, and Tubal, led by Gog. Blessed be that God, and blessed be his glorious name forever. And God willing, we will all do the things that the Father has asked that we do, that we might find a place in that wonderful time.